score. There's one rule.
Welcome back to the Champions Playbook Podcast. It's Jack and Scott. We are inside the Persimmon Pub. And for those of you who are listening to this on the back end, make sure to come out on Wednesday nights. I know it was a little cold last Wednesday night, which is this Wednesday night if you're listening to this right now. But I know it was a little cold last Wednesday night, so please be sure to come out and take advantage of the pizza special, flatbread special that we have going.
Yep.
So we've got food specials and drink specials, so make sure to tune in next week. Well, I guess it would be the week that you're listening to it, so this current week, for the next episode of the Champions Playbook Podcast. So we normally do two topics and one Q&A. So this is going to be this week's Ask Sherlock.
Yep.
Which is going to be great. So
here we go.
We're going to have a few questions just to show you guys on the back end how we do this. This might be a little bit of a shorter one, so just bear with us. But I know we're going to have some good hour and a half long podcast here this summer when there's a bunch of people here. So
when it's not freezing cold like it is today, we had this beautiful weather and then it like spooked everybody.
Which is crazy.
Wintry mix last
night. Dude, I woke up this morning and like I finished my work, right? I work from home, so I finished my work. And then I was like, all right, let me check the weather, see if I can go for, you know, play, you know, 9 holes or 18 before we film the Champions Playbook. And I looked up and it was like 45 degrees. And I was
we've
been having like 75 degree weather for the past like week and a half. And somehow I'll wake up and it's 45 outside. Crazy. Anyway.
So, should we begin?
Yes, Scott. So, explain to us kind of how the Champions Playbook podcast works as far as Ask Sherlock goes. And what's on the table? What's off the table? What can we ask, not ask?
This is the beauty of this part of the segment is you can literally ask me anything golf related. Mental, fitness, physical, swing, strategy, current events. I'm not always the guy to keep up on current events just because a lot of it I don't care about. Like, I don't get sucked into all the media. But ask me any question game related, whether it be for you, for somebody you know. We've had the, well, somebody I know needs help with. You know, it's like,
right.
You mean yourself. So,
asking
but
for a friend.
Yeah, asking for a friend. There it is. That's what I was looking for. So, come up to the mic, ask any question that you like. And you may come up to the mic more than once as long as everybody gets a chance.
So this is going to be like a little dress rehearsal. Usually, like, you guys can check in the past, in the archives of the Champions Playbook, we usually run these for like 45 minutes to like an hour and a half. So this is going to be like a little dry run for season two. But you all make sure to come out to the Persimmon Pub here at 7 o'clock on Wednesdays to get your questions answered by Scott himself.
And we got a sunset happening at the same time.
Bam, bam. There we go.
All right, so I think our first one here is looking like Mr. Elijah Tackett.
Step up to the mic and ask your question, sir.
Oh, flip it on. Is it on your
Try end? Now. Try now. Go ahead and talk into it, Elijah.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Hey,
there we go.
Can you hear yourself?
Yes. Partially.
What's your question, Elijah?
All right, Scott, what is your opinion on practicing to playing proportion?
Ooh, dude,
ooh.
This is, I love this.
Especially
question.
In preparation for a 3 or 4 day tournament.
Okay, so this is really cool. I see how I can explain this without having a diagram. So this is where maybe we need to have a whiteboard up here in case I run into some of these scenarios. It'd be nice to draw it.
I mean, we can put some sheet paper up on that board.
Yeah, we could do that up there.
Yeah.
So let's add that to the element. So
we will add that
noted.
To the element.
But the interesting thing about this way, so off season, you should be spending 90% of your time, at least early in the off season, driving home technique. And then as you move, and so about 10% would be playing. So people go, I'm off season, I'm just going to practice. Well, you need to play some because the swing's changing and you need to kind of play through that swing change a little bit. But very heavy focus on practice, drilling that technique down, building those habits, that muscle memory that everybody calls it. You know, I don't like that term because it's the nervous system. But I like it 90-10. And then if you think about the opposite end, the week of a tournament should be 10-90. So when you see people out there grinding really hard on their technique, the day of the tournament, it's like, hey man, you're cramming for the exam. If you ain't got it by now, you you're probably going to have it.
You're not going to get it.
You're not going to get it in the next 3 hours banging balls. Like, it's just not likely going to happen. So, usually that leads to – one of the reasons people do that is because they didn't do the preparation in the off season, and so then they're pressed to do that leading up to it. So that's kind of the ends of it. And so if you can think of everything else in the middle as kind of this roller coaster to the other end. So if you go from 10% play as you're leading up to a tournament, it should slowly rise to 90%. And that can ebb and flow. Now, it can be helpful to schedule that if you're somebody who's maybe got a busy schedule, or you're a tournament player, or you're a college student, high school student. Try and schedule that time because you know your tournament schedule out in advance. So sometimes you get invited to a tournament that you weren't anticipating on, so that screws with your whole schedule. This is one of the reasons. So I'm going to tie this into one of the current events. So, like, this year we have the Ryder Cup, we have the Olympics, plus we have the four major championships. So they've got six massive tournaments, plus you have the Players' Championship. So now you really have seven major events. A lot of times there's only a week or two of downtime, if not less than that, in between those. And then you have the FedEx Cup playoffs. So now I can't hold up any more fingers. I'll drop the microphone. And so this is why some of these players, I think you're seeing them pull out of the Olympics a couple years ago, was because of that. When golf finally came back to the Olympics, was like, they got to put it around the Zika virus. You know, it's like, oh, Zika, so we're not going to go. But really what it was is we are way overloaded on making changes to the schedule. So you can't ebb and flow through that. You just can't, if that makes sense. Like, you can't do that when you cram too many big events. So one of the other things, since Elijah's on some of the mini tours, there are these guys that, like, okay, I've got to win. I got to make enough money, so I'm going to play six straight weeks in a row. Good luck. Like, you need time to work on the technique, because as you play under pressure, you're going to revert some. And so you've got to keep the thing sharp and keep coming back, and you've got to keep timing your events so that you have time to work on your game and time to play. You can't stay at a high all the time, and you can't stay on technique all the time. Like, there's a balance.
And I think relating this to, like, the everyday player too, right, is, like, we call them range rats, yep. Right? And sorry if that offends some of you, but, like, when you're spending all of your time on the range, you don't know how to implement the stuff that you've been learning on the range into an actual round scenario.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
So, like, I think it's good to play. And to be completely honest, right here, for me personally, I've spent more time playing, and I need to spend more time practicing.
Yeah.
And so, like, I've noticed that just on my rounds where I'm kind of at a stalemate, right, in what I do. It's like, well, I need to get on the range more. But
yeah.
We've been preaching so much about not being a range rat that I've just been playing as much as I can.
Right, and there's value to that. Like, people tend to lean on one side over the other. Like, people tend to go one direction. Like, Bryson's going to be a range rat, and he needs to play more, if that makes sense. And then there are other guys out there that play a ton that need to practice more.
Yeah.
It's just trying to find that balance for your own game.
You know, and I wonder what that's like on the tour right now, right? Because I think we're seeing some, like, very interesting tendencies on the tour, right? Where, like, Rory is not winning as much as we think that he should, right?
Yeah.
Or Bryson, who's been, like, in the media about being on the range all the time. So I feel like we're seeing these weird dynamics even on the tour, where we need to start, like, really implementing that in ourselves, right? Like, Bryson spends a lot of time on the range. Rory doesn't necessarily in the public eye. So I think it's just kind of understanding what ratio works for you and then really sticking to it.
Yeah, but there's definitely an ebb and flow that needs to happen. You can't do it without that.
That's a good question. Or good question, Elijah. Good answer, Scott.
Do we have another one?
Ethan.
Come on.
What's up, dude?
Ethan.
He was just waiting for me.
he's really close to the mic, so we on.
Trying to think.
What's something in your personal game right now, Ethan, that you need help on? He's like, nothing. I'm a scratch golfer.
Pretty much a beast, so there's really nothing there.
I played with him. Played with him the other day. Driver or 3-wood off the tee?
Or 3-wood off the tee.
Which one?
I could go 4-iron off the tee right now. I'm completely fine, but I still have, like,
200 yards in on a par four with a four iron. But if I go driver, it might spray to the right, it might spray to the left, but I'll be closer if it does land in the fairway.
So this is one of the things I haven't mentioned to Ethan yet. I played with him the other day, and like he's gotten a lot better, but he still has this tendency to have this weak miss to the right a little bit. I would rather him have just the one-way miss, and he has moved his right hand into a stronger position, so a more draw type position, but it needs to go a little further. And with your driver in hand, you're more that way than you are with your irons. So if you adjust the grip a little more.
It's a comfort thing.
Yeah, I know. But like, so then the favorite question to that is like, so how's that working out for you? You know, like it's not like, but, yeah. but it's very normal. Like we go to comfort. That's what we humans do, right? Like, we're drawn towards comfortable things, easy things. It's really hard to move out of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, like, and you've preached this to me a lot, right, where we're trying to balance this, like, we got to take the right club off the tee, but at the same time, you and I are both pushing for distance, distance, distance. So it's like, what is the sweet spot, and does that depend on what kind of round you're playing too? Like, you and I go out on these rounds that I'll just call, like, for the sake of the exercise, like discovery rounds, right? Where we just like try and figure out what might be the best way. But there's also like a time and place for tournament, probably, right? And like Elijah and Elaine can speak to this too, where it's like, depending on the conditions and the wind and what's going on, it's like you got to take a different club off the tee, even though that's not something that we would necessarily do in one of our rounds that we're playing. So,
yeah.
I mean, talk me through a little bit about club selection off the tee, especially in some different different circumstances.
Well, this is back to the really simple one for me. It's like, know yourself, know the course, get on with it. Again, we're back to the we don't know ourselves very well. And so maybe that's a feel in your golf swing. Maybe that's knowing when to use a driver. I mean, there's so many different scenarios. Like, I want to give you a specific answer, but there's just not a specific scenario in which that will benefit you. So I want you to think about it this way. If you were to grab driver over three wood, how many strokes could you gain by hitting it 20 yards further versus how many could you lose by going 20 yards further? So, like, what's the potential stroke gain or loss?
Oh, and this is like going – sorry to interrupt you, but this is like going back to a couple tournaments ago when Spieth was playing.
Right.
And he was talking to Greller, and he was like, does this club bring bogey into play? Remember?
Yes,
he was like,
that.
Does three wood bring
that
bogey into play? And Greller initially said no because he was trying to get Spieth to be confident. But then after a while, Spieth pulled the 8-iron and laid up. But I think what the whole point of that story is like, does using your driver bring bogey into play? Or does it bring a higher score into play versus your three wood?
Right. And what's the cost of making a bogey on that hole? Like, not all bogeys are made equal. Like, if there's a high percentage of the entire field making bogey on that hole, and it's only going to bring bogey into play, but it could bring in a higher chance of birdie, then it may be worth taking the driver there.
Right, yeah.
And so it's really understanding the context of the game that you're playing in. And this is the beauty of match play, right? Like, you know the risk directly associated with the person you're playing against.
Oh, love that. Yeah, yeah.
You don't know the whole field when you're playing in a stroke play event. And so you tend to have to play slightly more conservative in stroke play on the whole and just be aggressive in certain little moments to try and grab, you know, an extra couple of strokes here, an extra couple of strokes there, or to avoid negative shots there. And so end of tournaments act like match play too.
Yeah, and I'm actually glad that Ethan asked this question because, like, when you're you know, when you're talking about like a match play scenario or when you're just going out to play with your buddies, right?
Yep.
And let's say,
yep,
you know, me and Paul Farmer betting $5 on this hole, right? It's like, you know, if I'm playing after him, I can adjust my strategy depending on what he does. So I think the moral of the story is knowing oneself and what you can hit in different situations.
Correct.
And how is that going to have an effect on your overall score?
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%.
Love that.
100%. I think that started with Evan Coppola. He said 100%. 100%. 100%.
Coppola.
99%. So
meanwhile, Ethan looking like Brooks over there with the visor look.
Yeah.
Did you get,
hey,
you
that's
got
a
called.
Good that's a good role model to have, man.
You got called that like once. What Seriously. Was it, like at the Bear, or was it on like the?
It's every time I wear those.
Every time you wear the.
Brian just rolled in. Brian's always good for a question or two.
Oh
we'll,
no!
We'll give him. We'll give
we're,
him. A
we're
minute.
Calling people
yeah.
out.
Yeah. So, anything you want, golf related, Brian. Harder the question, the better.
So while he's thinking of a question, I got a question for you too.
I knew you did. I'm sitting here going, I bet he's got one.
So Dell Match Play event was a couple weeks ago.
Yep.
And it introduced the topic of should the PGA Tour incorporate more match play tournaments into the regular season schedule.
Mm.
So I've heard a couple things about this. One, some people like match play, you know, for the sake of match play, right? You know, it's mano y mano, right? It's not versus right. the scoreboard kind of thing. But this also introduces to a topic that I think the PGA Tour, this is why they lean away from match play events, is that when you get to the end, it gets a little bit boring, right? Because it's not like, you know,
because you're down to just like,
well, and it's not like Elijah can climb up the leaderboard on a Sunday and make things interesting, right? Mm-hmm. But it's more like, okay, fine, it's, you know, me versus Elijah here. Like, it gets a little bit boring, especially when you have to start these match play tournaments on like a Wednesday in order to get everything done. Well, so it's like people are burnt out by Friday.
Well, I think the first two days of match play.
Super fun.
Are pretty exciting,
super fun,
and
super
the
fun.
End isn't. And yet, stroke yeah. play is the flip flop of that.
Yeah, exactly.
So, what I would like to see is kind of what they do for the national championship is you play stroke play to seed everybody in the first two rounds, and then you do match play on the back end. Or you could do match play to play into the stroke play to finish off the. Like, you could do it a couple different ways, which could be really exciting. So, I don't know. Do a mixed event.
You know, and in listening to all the podcasts that I listen to that are golf-related, you know, nobody's ever introduced the fact of doing, you know, match play up until, you know, Saturday and then stroke play to finish it out on Sunday. I think that would be an insane format.
Stroke
you
play.
You got to play into the field on a Sunday, and then you play stroke play on a Sunday. And
based on the number you beat a guy by, that's how, like, that's how much further you are under par. Like, if you win a match, like, 6-5, and another guy wins a match 2-1, you've got like a 4-stroke advantage.
Well, and I was about
guy.
To ask that too. I could be crazy, but for the FedEx Cup Championship, right? Don't you actually get a certain amount of strokes depending on your ranking?
Yep.
Yeah. So
yep,
like
they changed that this year.
Yeah. So
or
like that.
Year,
that's. I think
ago.
That's so sick.
Remember.
So imagine if you like beat X amount of opponents, or you know your world rank whatever. You know, you get X amount of strokes going into Sunday, which would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see them play around with formats like that. It'd be a lot of fun.
That'd be sweet. So, okay, so that addresses the match play issue. Another kind of subtopic on that is, should we have a major that's decided in match play?
Ooh, well, so keep this in mind. All of golf used to be match play.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the Masters used to be match play, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's correct.
So should we go back to our roots? But you know, the argument against that is going to be that, you know, the same argument that I made last is that once you get into the weekend, people start getting a little bit stale, especially when your guy isn't in the running.
Right. I don't know. Like, it also depends on who's in there, right? So if it was like a
which brings us into the a current topic. Where the PGA is thinking about introducing a purse for top players.
Oh, man. Ah, shoot. You would open up this can of worms.
I'm going to open it up, yeah.
You know, geez, why don't you ask me hard questions here? Wow. I just got showed a photo that was that Elaine fishing when she was little? Wow. That's the last time you caught a fish?
Things that you can
just
only get
at the bridge
when
yet.
You show up to the pub on Wednesday
That's
nights.
That's right. What was the question?
So the question was... I'm
completely gone.
Well, I believe we're on the topic of match play as a major.
Yep.
And how everything prior... Or everything used to
oh,
be match play.
Oh, the big purse that they're putting out.
Correct.
There.
And then the big purse that they're putting in for top players to enter into events. Which is interesting to me. It's interesting. Part of me wants to go, hell no. These top players shouldn't be getting more money for doing what they're already good at.
Right.
But then on the contrary, if we, you know, we're looking at the micro right there, but if we zoom out to the macro, we start to understand that, like, well, wait.
Is it drive if, overall traffic
does
to...
Does it drive traffic to the game, which then ends up making the game more popular, which then brings everybody back to, you know, a better state of golf. And to, this is interesting. This is my take on this. My take is no, we should not introduce that purse. Because golf is already trending in such a good direction. I feel like
40%, the industry as a whole is up 40%
exactly.
Last year.
Like, it's already trending in the right direction. I don't understand why we need to introduce this purse for the same thing that we've already been getting. If COVID never happened and golf was, you know, trending down like it was before the pandemic, I would be like, okay, fine. Like, that might be a good way to drive traffic to
right,
the game.
Right.
But right now, no. Right now, my answer is no.
So, I'm kind of middle of the road on this because, like, I don't really understand the decision. Like, I think for that, I'm going to sit in the middle. I will say this as something that really bothers me. Having coached tour players, currently coaching tour players, worked for a gentleman who's coached tour players, been around some high-level college players who are having to work a job or two jobs and try to get ready to try and get out there that are very talented players, guys and girls. When these guys and girls, so let's think about this. So to go to Q school for the men, for the ladies, it's like what? So you're looking at about 10 grand out of pocket total for the women for all stages combined. Is that correct? Yeah, with all your expenses incurred. Guys, it's
eight
about
to 10
five.
Grand, yeah.
Guys, it's like 5 grand per stage, plus you have to get into the. You have a qualifying stage now too. So you're looking at 15,000 plus, let's say it's 2,500. I think it's $17,500.
First of all, just without going any forward, that just boggles my mind, right? Because like, if you look at the barrier to entry in any other big sport in this country, like, it's not money oriented, right? It's pure skill.
Right. So there's a massive, and we're talking thousands of guys that are doing this. So, I mean, if you just think about qualifying in stage one, the tour's made millions of dollars right off of that, right off the top. Like, easy.
Especially these guys who think they're tour players.
Here's
and they go in and get beat up.
I don't even necessarily so much – I'm not bothered by the dollar amount as much as I am bothered by the fact of the only thing that they get if they place in the top 25, I believe it is, for each stage, is you get a ticket into the next stage.
Which then
pay
requires
them
more
back
money.
Their entry fee.
Yeah.
At least pay them back their entry fee, or do some sort of scaled pay structure where maybe it's not winner gets
that's such a good
25,000, but maybe they get. I mean, just at the very minimum, pay them back their 5 grand.
Well, here's the thing too: if they're good enough,
plus travel expenses. So let's call it $6,000.
Even take travel expenses out of it. So
right.
The same Elijah said.
Right.
So Elijah was talking about how the same thing's happening with Monday qualifying, right?
Yeah.
But like, here's what I was gonna say previously is like, if you're good enough to make it to that next stage, like the tour should be saying like, yeah, like here's your money back, go compete in the next stage. I don't understand that, like. They should definitely be giving the amount of dollars back to that player to then continue the journey. Like, because if they're good enough, they should be good enough, and they're going to earn you revenue on the tour level if they are good enough. So don't take their money up front. You know, like, take everybody up. Like, make that be an incentive for you to go out and play well.
Yeah. Well, and this brings up the conversation we've had early on in the podcast as we started here was talking about women's golf. And so, like, the LPGA doesn't have those kinds of dollars. And I know they're a separate entity, but this could be the chance for the PGA Tour to try and help merge those two and say, hey, why don't we split this a 20 million, 20 million, 20 million?
It also begs the question, too, is like we've talked about previously, too, about the USGA and the PGA like allotting money to go and fix courses, right?
Right.
For new
where's,
style
where's
play.
That dollar?
Like, so like if you've got this $40 million budget to then get top players to show up at some of these events – why are we not allocating that money in better ways?
Here's the other thing. When you start incentivizing players for their media presence, Because that's essentially what it is, right? For their media presence.
Takes away the incentive
of
winning the tournament.
Yep. And so I think what you'll actually do is you'll lower the quality of play as a whole. That's the danger.
Yeah.
Like, do you want to do that? Look what happened to Rory when he signed a $250 million contract with Nike.
Yeah. Started playing like crap.
Where's the incentive? I mean, obviously, they want to win the golf tournament. But when you're not hungry, when there's nothing to be hungry for, really hard to do.
And you see that, and to your same point, you see that with early Rory, right? Early Rory was kicking ass and taking names.
Yep.
Right? And now you see him sign this massive contract with Nike that does not even include his TaylorMade endorsement, or his TaylorMade sponsorship, that mm-hmm. doesn't include anything else that he does off the top to appear in commercials or whatever he does. So when you give this guy the ability to just quit golf altogether, like, I just don't think the guy tries as hard. And even if they do, or even if they are mentally tough to try that hard, I still don't think that the same hunger is out there.
Like,
I mean, look at Will Zalatoris right now. Will Zalatoris is playing high quality golf, and he is not in the mainstream media at all. And so, like, you wonder, like, is Rory better than Will Zalatoris? Like, overall, like, yes. But why is he performing better than him right now?
So then you're going to get Ricky Fowler's going to make a whole much more money than Zalatoris.
Well, and also begs the question, too, when we're talking about top players. I saw this one comment on social media. They're like, so are we going to draw the line above or below Ricky Fowler?
One of the other comments I saw, this is awful. People, like, feel bad for Ricky Fowler, but I kind of don't at the same time. But, like, this idea of people said, well, this is a PGA Tour's attempt to keep Ricky Fowler relevant.
Right.
Like, if you read through the comment feeds, there's some really funny ones, and there's some painfully, like, harsh ones as well. But I don't know what, like, what are you trying to do? Like, what's the objective of those dollars? Like, I know you gave your PR statement as the objective of your dollars, but, like, what's the real reason for those dollars?
Yeah.
Like, was there an attempt made to reach out to the LPGA Tour and do that? Probably not.
And
I don't know.
If we're going off topic,
there's so much behind the scenes. I just don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're going off topic here too about LPGA, it's like, I feel like the first step is have like a tournament that incorporates PGA players and LPGA players to play together. Like, wouldn't that be sick? Like,
yeah, you could sponsor that.
Why are we not like slowly introducing the games together to where like the PGA and the LPGA are like brother and sister, right? Instead of just being like long lost cousins.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the responsibility in many ways does lie with the guys LPGA to say, hey, we need your help.
Mm-hmm.
We'd love your help. You know, this is talking about extreme ownership, like the books that Brooks has us reading. And, like, owning your side of it's really hard. Like, if I were the LPGA and I saw them go out with that $40 million, I'd be going,
it's not the players. I think the players have shown that they're interested in
merging
the games.
I think there are a lot of men that are trying to do that.
It's just admin. It's the admin at the PGA level that's like that doesn't want to do it for some odd and godly
reason. Can you imagine if the LPGA had $40 million more dollars?
Hold on. So Elaine said it's the LPGA. Is that correct?
I don't. I'll put it this way.
I don't know. There's probably like equal on both sides.
Yeah,
it's probably equal on both sides.
I don't know what the insides of it are, but like trying to take the ownership of it, of the PGA Tour needs to take their ownership of it, the LPGA needs to take their ownership of it, whatever it is. Like, I'm having to take a lot of ownership over the things that I screw up here in my job, the things I screw up in my marriage, the things I screw up in my parenting, and just over overall life stuff, whether that be health, fitness, whatever. Like, I have to own my side of the issue. You know, like, this is on me. Like, if the LPGA needs more dollars, they can't just go, why isn't anybody giving us more dollars? Like, well, how are we going to get more dollars? Well, the PGA Tour just said, we're pumping out $40 million. Why don't we go to the guy who has all the money, just like you would, like, if you're trying to grow a business and you're just struggling, you might go and find a venture capitalist that's going to jump in and, like, can take your thing and push it way up. That's had success doing that.
Here's
now, you're
going
to have to give up some things in order to do that.
We're making the assumption that, like, the LGP,
LPGA
is, like, on board with this strategy, right? Like, the question I would ask Elaine is, like, is the LPGA, like, or do they want to be
She doesn't know.
Do they want to be their own? Like, that's true. But, like, from somebody who is close to the game, like, do they want to, are they so prideful that they want to be their own entity and they don't want the men's help in, like, growing their side of the game? Like, because if it's a pride issue, then I can definitely see, like, a disconnect. But I think both organizations definitely have the resources in order to make something work.
Oh man, if they
so
could
now
merge
we just
together.
Have to define what the problem is. Is it because the LPGA wants to be their own entity and really bad wants to do it? Because then the question or like the answer that I would have is they don't have the money or the resources or the likeliness to do that on their own. So it's now about does that right. admin have the you know the humility to then ask for help from the men's side of the game.
Yeah, and to say, hey, we're willing to give up a cut of whatever here in order to get the resources that you have to help grow the game.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, those are things that I think will happen in time. It's only a matter of time before that happens. And there's a reason why this is my econ side of me major talking, but, like, there's a reason why collusion is not allowed. Like, Ford and Chrysler and whatever other car company you want to talk about, they can't share all of their inner strategies with each other and say, hey, let's drive prices up this way and do this. Like, it's illegal to do that because when you collude with another entity, it makes you too big and too powerful.
I mean, it's a felony too.
Right.
Collusion.
Right. No, right. You can't.
In some
you
senses,
can't.
Yeah.
Right. But the reason why that's there is because of what you're capable of doing.
Right. Right.
For better or worse. Like, but like for the LPGA and PGA to merge as one unit.
Well, I don't think they're going to merge. I'm just asking, like, do both sides have the humility to come together in order to support the overall action of growing golf?
Yeah. And it would probably grow both the men's and the women's game.
Totally.
It would grow both. That's my opinion on it. We wouldn't know until it actually happens, but that's speculation. So,
well, dang.
I don't know. This is a good topic.
This question has gone on a long time, but I actually
do
think
we have
it's,
one
a,
more?
It's a good focus of the episode, so that's good.
Maybe we have one more? I think we have one more maybe. Maybe. Brian? Any sort of question? Brian's always good for a question.
Oh, he's coming up to the mic. Here we go.
Brian's a lot of – like, I enjoy spending time with Brian. Like, he's a pretty cool cat. He's gotten a lot better in his golf game. Hit me.
Yeah,
he's got a good coach. He's got a team of coaches.
Yes.
If you have a question, Brian, just go ahead and speak into the mic.
Hit me with your best shot.
All right. Well, you guys already talked about the first thing I was going to ask about, which is the player incentive program. I was curious your opinion on that, but
well, I mean,
you kind of already talked about it.
Yeah, so. I mean I guess trying to give my point.
We kind of like tailed off into like PGA, something else. LPGA, but like if we're actually going to address this question, I mean, I'm going to stick to my guns here and say there's better allocation for that kind of money that would grow the overall sport, other than paying overpaid athletes more money on top of it. I mean, like, Scott and I have talked about on previous podcasts, too, about how, like, golfers are severely overpaid for what they do. Like,
think about it. Morikawa made $2 million a couple weeks back when he won.
And the Barstool guys were making this joke, too. Like, they were joking around with Kisner, and they said, well, what'd you shoot the other day, Kiz? Like, 77? And he goes, yeah, I probably made $77,000 with it, too. Like the fact that somebody can go out there and shoot, like, what is that, 5 over par and still make, like, $77,000.
All,
like,
he has to do is make the cut.
Like, all you got to do is make the cut, and then you're available for the prize pool. So it's like, here's the question. Like, golfers are extremely overpaid. There's got to be a better way to spend $40 million.
I would say male golfers in particular.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
It's not a female that's getting paid $2 million for a win.
No. Exactly. But, like, we're talking about the PGA Tour's allocation of this $40 million purse, right? Like, if we're leaving women out of it, golfers are severely overpaid, and there's got to be a better allocation to grow more traction towards the game than just paying the biggest stars more money.
Right.
And So that's my take on it.
I think I'm going to stay with you on that. I just would like to see the dollars go somewhere else. We're going to pay the – I mean, these guys are already making actually, can you look up the earnings from – let's go 2019, since last year wasn't a full year.
We're talking about earnings for –
for the top 10 or 20 PGA Tour players. Like, that's a number I want to see. I don't recall it off the top of my head. I'll probably never forget it. Okay. Elaine's going to get LPGA if you can get PGA Tour top money earners 2019. Because we didn't have a full year last year.
So let's see. PGA Tour money list leaders. ESPN even has a freaking thing appointed. So hold on, don't look. So what are we? We're adding 2019. So we're doing 2019. Here's what we got. So in 2019, year that Brooks Koepka went on his absolute tear, right? So Brooks that season won $9.6 million. Rory, right behind him, made 7.7. And then if we fast forward all the way down to the end at number 10, Webb Simpson won 4.6.
Like, I'm going, wait, Webb Simpson made 4.6. Like, did he even do anything?
Let's
that
go.
Year?
Let's
like,
go
that's the,
even.
That's a weird part. Like,
let's get even crazier.
Okay.
Let's go even crazier. Tournament. Hold on. Let's go even crazier. So if we're looking at the people who are going to break $1 million in earnings for that season, we have to go all the way down to number 113, Nick Watney, who made $1,008,000 that year.
Who hasn't been relevant?
You have to be. He is on the leaderboard of money earners, number 113. 113.
If y'all could see, if you're listening to this podcast, if you could see Jack's face right now,
like, it's just crazy. But like, 113 for PGA is 1 point. Hold on. I had
just
I had
over
it.
A million.
$1,008,000. Number 113 on the earnings list for the LPGA Tour was how much? You said $94,000. So these guys are getting paid close to 10x just from being on the PGA Tour versus the LPGA.
I can tell you from entry fees, travel expenses around the world, all that, like there's not much left after that 94,000. You've got to pay instructors, you got to pay personal trainers, you've got to pay caddy fees. Like that 94,000 quickly becomes like 15 to 20.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
And I mean, that's
then you got to take taxes off. Like there's not much left. It sounds like a lot.
And you got to live, right? So it's like how much like how much of that is actual like a living, right? I mean like being a golfer, probably, you know, they're severely overpaid on the PGA side, but like, you know, at the same time, just playing devil's advocate, they also have a lot of overhead that not a lot of other athletes have, right?
Because it's owned by the organization rather than like,
well, correct.
The NFL is owned by like,
right. And if
you're
we look at like
payout,
let's look at MLB because MLB is like guaranteed. Once you sign that contract, like you're pretty much guaranteed. It's a guaranteed contract for the most part, right? Let's look at, I mean, this is probably a terrible example, but like we'll look at the best player in the game right now, Mike Trout, who's making like $30 million a year, something around that, like $30 million a year. And that's all guaranteed. And like the team obviously covers all the overhead for traveling, for hotels, for all that stuff. And then he gets all of his equipment for free, obviously from sponsorships and stuff like that. So, I mean, like if we're going to compare like Mike Trout to, let's say, Dustin Johnson, right? Or even Brooks Koepka in 2019, like Brooks really isn't making all that much compared to like Mike Trout.
No, but this comes back to, so this
just
is
playing devil's advocate.
No, this is good. So if I take a different angle off of this, so another arm off of this would be, we are showing as a country what we value by what we spend the most money on.
Well, you spend the most time watching.
Yeah, so we watch, I mean, we're talking about superstars and athletes, and really the superstars from the movie stars and all that, those are declining and athletes are quickly on the rise, and so you're seeing these massive payouts for these top professional athletes. I don't even want to know whatever, I don't want to know what that number is that you just showed.
Dude, so Mike Trout signed the largest deal in sports ever. So he is getting paid $426 million.
Over how many years?
I mean, it's like a long contract. I believe it's 12 years.
So it's still 30 something million dollars.
And then Patrick Mahomes just topped him. So I mean, if we want to look at Patrick Mahomes' contract, he just made let's see. Ooh, I'm having a hard time finding the actual number. So, okay, this is crazy. He has a close to a half a billion dollar contract too. Just off the top of my head, I know that. But his guaranteed money right now, fully guaranteed at signing, it's like somebody wrote you a check right there at your signing day, $63 million.
Like, so like we say golfers are overpaid, but relative to some of these other athletes, you actually have to earn it. Like that's still a, that's a,
yeah,
you're talking about guaranteed contracts. So in some ways that's guaranteed. It's like what this $40 million is doing, is it's almost giving these guys a guarantee whether you play good or bad, as long as you're making media presence.
Well,
it's going to become more of an entertainment factor of like,
let me counter that too.
Ricky and Bubba and all these guys get like all cool and bring back the golf boys again like they did back in the,
there's also a certain amount of like
2010 range.
If we're going to argue like this pay thing too, there's also like, there's also a reason why those guys are worth that amount of money. It's not just all based off of like media presence and like, oh, he's a top player. Like these guys too are signing up for, like, just speaking of baseball, you're signing up for 162 games a year where you're expected to play at your top performance. Like, it is a long and slow burn for an entire season. Whereas, like, golf, you can pick and choose what events you show up to as well, right? So it's like you're in charge of your destiny at the golf level because it is such an individual sport. But, like, there is a certain expectation when you're playing in some of these team sports that, like, you have to be consistent day in and day out. If that makes any sense, and that's a job in itself.
I could see
that's
that.
A job in itself.
Yeah, that's
but,
fair.
Like with that being said, too, if we're just going to talk about golf, like you know, the women definitely need to take strides into making the women's game just as entertaining and just as you know, important as the men's game. At the end of the day,
I would even go as far as possibly lowering the top pay and spread that purse out more.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah.
So that sounds a little different. It's a little different strategy.
Are you talking about just the LPGA or the PGA Tour?
The PGA.
I don't know how I feel about that.
So then you balance. If you're going to do this incentive thing, like.
Because wouldn't you want to do it the other way then? Cut it up to the, you know, bring it up to the top and not spread it out further down?
Yes and no. You'd take the guys that are taking the easy check. And I think you're incentivizing guys that are struggling to make the cut to make the cut. It makes them work harder to make the cut.
Ah, yeah, yeah, I get that.
Like, the top guys are still going to want to win. Like they're not sitting there going, oh, this putt's worth $300,000. Like, that's not in their head. They're trying to win the golf tournament, like, with three holes left to play. And they don't care how much each stroke is worth finishing this out. They're trying to win the golf tournament. But those guys down at the bottom that are trying to play week in and week out, like, they're really grinding it out hard to try and get to that. Hey, maybe I can get better. I can get a few more dollars in. I can travel a little more. I can play some other tournaments. So potentially spreading that out where you – I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
So
you,
like,
don't see that in most incentive structures in businesses.
Right. So I'm curious about that because, like, yes, in one regard – and we're going to wrap this up here. This could be our last topic of the night. But, you know, I think we're both trying to accomplish the same thing when you're trying to spread it out to the bottom and I'm trying to push it up to the top, because my theory is when you push the cut up – now you're incentivizing these guys where it's like, oh, shoot, like
if I don't make the cut,
we're going, you know? So it's like, but it also incentivizes even the top players in the game to play because they're going to make more money at the end of the day, right? So if you spread it out too much, I feel like you're going to get these golfers, you know, not saying that Rory does this, but you're going to get some of like the stereotypical golfers like Rory who are just, you know, not going to put in as much effort. And if you push that money towards the top, it incentivizes them to play better.
I think what we should probably do this would be interesting. And bring this up in a topic maybe just as a side point next week. But if we look at overall GDP growth in the United States versus inflation versus payouts
versus
tournaments, like versus earnings in tournaments. Like,
yeah, I like that.
Are they traveling in the same track as GDP is, or are they exponentially rising?
Great question. Yeah,
Are they way ahead? Are they if they're in track with it, then they're just doing what the market bears. But if they're way ahead of it, then that maybe points out to an issue of like, hey, to me, that would be by definition overpaying based on a massive rise in the overall GDP.
You
got to
compare your variables, right? Yeah. You got to compare your variables. That's a good one.
So like we're giving an arbitrary, like they're getting paid too much. Well, relative to MLB players, relative to the top MLB players, the top PGA Tour players aren't making that kind of money.
It'd be interesting, too, if we could, like, categorize it all the way down to, like, types of performances, too. You know, like, if Mike Trout is putting on 162 performances a year, you know, is he getting paid relative to what some of these
what the best golfer on the PGA Tour is getting played, right? For,
yeah.
Because I guarantee you the number one player in the world, we'll call it Dustin Johnson for now, is only playing in X amount of tournaments a year, right? Just
yeah.
for just for the sake of number.
They're
we'll
usually
say,
playing
we'll
high
say,
20s to
I was
low
30s. We're going to say 20, right? Just
yeah.
for just
but
a,
those are four-day events.
Right, right. Two.
Plus you have 2 days on the front end. One's right. usually a, some sort of sponsor thing. The other's
– That's true.
You know.
So, I mean, like, if we're going to count the rounds, if we're going to count four rounds over 20 tournaments, like, that's 80 performances.
That's still half of –
Yeah, 80 performances compared to 162 over the course of a baseball season, right? Now, of course, we're choosing the sport that has the highest number of games played in a season, but it still begs the question of, like, are these guys actually getting paid for how they're performing?
I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's I think that's what we're saying is that we don't know.
Yeah.
So we'll report back next week when we kind of have like a figure.
It'd be neat to see.
I think it would be too.
It'd be but a fun exercise because we could both be blown out of the charts going, well, we got that wrong.
Right, right. Or we could just be, you know, misconstruing the variables too. You
yeah.
know, there might be some hidden factors in there that we're not even considering. So, but that's a good question.
Cool.
And that was a really good first episode or second episode of season two here at the Persimmon Pub. Wait, the third episode.
Let's
third
save
episode.
It.
Yeah, yeah, we'll save it.
Because I think the people that are planning to come next week, based on what I've got so far,
yep.
are going to really like them. We're going to talk about Stuart Sink's win from this last weekend.
Mm, great one.
And how that can apply to your golf game.
Amazing.
So come out and listen to that. Like, so if you're listening to that, Sherlock, please come out and listen to that next week. That'll be our first topic. We'll be talking about Stuart Sink. I honestly think he's playing better golf than he's ever played. His technique's better. His whole game's better. And he's not the longest hitter. Now, he's stronger, but, like, he's not the longest hitter out there, and he's playing some incredible golf right now. And he's got his son on the bag. How
and
cool
yeah,
is that?
He's on the older side, which is great. So.
Yeah. He's in the top 20 right now in
wow.
driving distance, and he's 47.
Wow, that's great, yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So we should compare, like, him and Cooch and Phil and, like, some of these older guys on the tour. And
they've
like,
gotten in the gym and they're working out,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah. Or if we can just chalk that up to technology, too. So we don't know, but we'll have to dive into that next week. But
that'll be fun. And, but how that applies to you, right? So, like, that's the goal of that
exactly,
topic. Like,
exactly.
Not just talk about Stuart Sink, but, like, how that applies to you and your best golf is yet ahead
right.
of you.
Yeah, exactly. And for some
that's
of these guys
goal.
Who are even out here at the bridge who are even on like the older side being like, I just can't hang with the young guns anymore. You know, it's like, well, wait, if you want to, you can. You know,
got a guy's 88 trying to shoot his age. Has never shot his age.
Bam. There we go.
We got him to 90. We got to make two more putts.
Two more putts.
Two
there
more
you go.
Putts.
So we're going to be talking about that next on the Champions Playbook next week from inside or hopefully outside of the Persimmon Pub.
Weather looks better.
Whatever the weather dictates. But y'all, please come out. We're going to have some flatbread pizzas, some drink specials. I thought about this. If the cost works, we can call it $5 flatbreads.
Ooh,
$5
dude,
flatbreads,
I love
that.
Dude.
$5 flatbreads coming in hot for you guys. So make sure to come out to the Persimmon Pub every Wednesday. It'll be a great way for you guys to come in and play some afternoon golf, play some cheaper golf if you're a River Club member, and then just come in here, stay, and eat a couple flatbreads and drink a couple drinks, and it'll be a good time. So it'll be a great way to cap off your Wednesday. But from that, with that, I will say it's been Scott and Jack from inside the Persimmon Pub here at Franklin Bridge, and we'll see you on the next one. Peace.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Champions Playbook podcast. Trying to get you to shoot lower scores, the first step to do that, go buy a copy of my book on Amazon, The Champions Playbook, Thinking Your Way to Lower Scores. And no, it's not what you think. You're actually going to think before you hit the shot, not while you're hitting the shot. Well, and I'll also say this, go check me out on Instagram, at shassygolf, that's two S's, two E's, shassygolf. I've got all sorts of free content on there. I've got Student of the Week. I'll let you know when all my podcasts are coming available. So go check it out. And I'm here to help you do that very one thing, shoot a lower score.